Hey friends, welcome back to another Field and Garden podcast. It is your host and friend, Lisa Mason Ziegler. And hey, thanks for hitting the button and joining us here today. And I always love it when I get to talk to old friends. And I am here today with Jonathan Lease of Spring Forth Farms, located in North Carolina. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Lisa.
And he and I are going to get started here in just a moment. But for you, if perhaps this is your first time visiting us, I just want to let you know that the Field and Garden podcast is brought to you by thegardenersworkshop.com. And if you want to learn more about the work that we're doing, please drop in over at our website. We have tons of resources, videos, how-tos, courses, our online garden shop where we basically sell the same tools, seeds, and supplies that you hear me mention from time to time, as well as my books. And friends, with that, I am going to just jump right in here with Jonathan. And I'm going to ask Jonathan to introduce himself for those of you that may not have either taken Jonathan and his wife, Megan, are the instructors of one of our courses called the No-Till Microscale Flower Farm course, or if you have maybe connected with them through the ASCFG or seen them around, I'll let Jonathan introduce himself. Take it away, Jonathan.
Yeah, so hi, everyone. I'm glad everyone's listening to this podcast because, Lisa, I just learned so much from all of the different things you put out. Like, I listened today to the single cut, one and done, cool flowers thing that you did on a seed talk. And no matter how much you know and how much experience you have, there's always a new something to learn or something new way of looking at things that you can hear. So I do really appreciate that.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's true. I learn something every time I talk to Dave Dowling. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
So our farm, Spring Forth Farm, is, well, it's like the title of the course says, no-till micro-scale flower farm. So we're growing, actually, it's like almost every year we're growing on less area than the year before. So we used to grow in the field and tunnels, and now we're only growing annuals in our tunnel space, which is one 30 by 96 foot unheated hoop house and three 16 by 80 foot caterpillar tunnels. So that adds up to 20 beds, and we always save one to grow vegetables for ourselves. So we have 19 beds of annuals. Each one is 2.5 by 80. So it's not a lot of space, but we're really pushing out the flowers out of that space. And in order to make the most of that space, we're only growing flowers in the spring. So our anemones will start blooming sometime between Valentine's Day and the second week of March. And the middle to end of March, our ranunculus start blooming. And this year, we're going to stop harvesting flowers on May 31st. So that's it. At that point, we'll sell whatever we have in our cooler, and we'll focus on getting in cover crops and things like that.
All right. So, and y'all are located in which zone?
Right. So we are about half an hour north of Durham, North Carolina, which used to be zone 7A. And, it still mostly is. I mean, this last cold blast we had, we got down to 8 degrees twice. Two nights in a row. When we have an Arctic blast, it can get down to single digits or even zero. But I would say our average winter lows are in the 20s. 25 to 35 probably is our average winter low, and the average high is in the 45 to 50. I should also add that we sell all of our flowers. We sell to two wholesalers that only sell local flowers to florists. So we're moving through two wholesale companies. One's a cooperative, farmers cooperative that we're part of. And that's how we sell all our flowers.
And I'm sure that could be a podcast in itself, because I know that there's a lot of people right now, wow, I wonder how they do that. So we'll have to put that in our notebook. We'll have to be sure Kelly or Jesse gets that on our agenda to talk about that on another day, because today we're talking about something that I get lots of questions about. And even though I am not a strictly no-till farmer, because I have conventional and some no-till beds, cover cropping is something that I think a lot of growers and even gardeners, they feel guilty if they don't cover crop. You know, they feel like that's something that needs to be done to really rejuvenate and help the soil. And so before they really maybe get, especially if you're farming, before you get the farming work down and your management of that going, they're throwing in cover crops. And we're going to talk today about some of the pitfalls, perhaps, particularly related to no-till, that I tell people, just put the cover crop on the back burner until, I mean, at least till your second year. I mean, get some crops in the ground, because there's a lot more to cover cropping than just planting it and making the most out of it, isn't there?
There is. And I feel the same way, that like we almost feel like we need permission to not have cover crops.
Yep.
And I'll say there are a few things that cover crops could do for your soil that like nothing else can do. But really, in the no-till mindset, what we're trying to do is have living roots in the ground as much as possible. And on a micro farm, you may not be able to take a bed out of production for the amount of time that you would need to put a cover crop in it and then terminate that cover crop. And that's the whole process. I know we'll talk about that. But I just want people to feel like, well, if they have a small farm and they're keeping all their beds in production all the time, they take out a crop, they immediately plant another crop, they're having living roots in the soil all the time. They're right. Already doing what they, the most that they can do to take care of their soil at that point, which is feeding the soil life through the roots of their plants that are releasing all these wonderful exudates that improve the soil. And so if you're able to just keep cash crops in your beds all the time, you're doing a great job, and pat yourself on the back. Maybe you don't need to cover crop at that point.
That's a great point, Jonathan. I mean, right. That's just such a great point. And that may, I just wrote myself a note and I'm going to ask you now, didn't you all do a little experiment planting sunflowers in your tunnel or zinnias or something to kind of use it as a cover crop instead of planting what we would conventionally call a cover crop?
We did. And the biggest reason for that is we don't have a way to irrigate what you would normally think of as a cover crop in the tunnel. We did try one year using drip tape because that's what we use on like wheat or rye or something. And I can't tell you, the roots of those grass type cover crops are like a giant squid wrapping their tentacles around the drip tape. And it is impossible to get the drip tape out. So unless we invested in some sort of overhead sprinkler, that type of thing isn't available to us. And so instead, what we did is we thought, well, what are just the crops that we enjoy having around and that feed the microbial life on our farm, the parasitoid wasps and the butterflies and the bees? And we thought, okay, well, we love growing flowers, so we plant zinnias, sunflowers, basil, a few other things, tithonia. The two requirements are they have to be a long season, so we only have to plant them once, and they can't be reseeding like crazy. So we don't do celosia or rudbeckia.
Because, right, good point.
You let those go to seed, you know, you've really set yourself up to do some work after that, weeding them out.
Yes.
And if people are interested in that idea, I just wanted, and I'll just say this and we can start talking about some of the pitfalls. The USDA has a great guide that you can find just by Googling cover crop periodic table. And it organizes cover crops according to the temperatures they need, how much water they want, their growing habit, like if they're a vine or a upright. And it really opened my eyes to some things that you might could use for cover crops that we don't normally think about as cover crops, like sweet potatoes. Nothing is going to smother out weeds like a sweet potato in the summer. And so that's a great
good idea.
Yeah, that might be the right thing to use as a cover crop in your context. And they have a lot of creative ideas in there, which is what just got us thinking about using sunflowers and zinnias and things like that, which, since we don't grow them as cash crops, anything in those families as cash crops, we're not worried about diseases by planting them in the beds over and over again.
That's awesome. So let's talk about what are the pitfalls of when, especially related to no-till, with, the little flag I send up whenever I talk about cover crop is that people, in my experience, most often leave cover crops in too long. You know, they let them go past that optimal time to extinguish it, however you're going to do it, and let it get old and tough and go to seed and all kinds of problems. But let's talk about, because this is a result of it, right? Planting cover crops without having a plan to terminate them. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think that's the number one pitfall of cover cropping in a no-till system is not knowing before you plant the cover crop how you're going to terminate it. And that really comes down to selecting the appropriate cover crop for the time you're going to plant it. Just as an example, we love using rye as a winter cover crop. But if you're wanting to plant something in April, you know, like I think we could transplant sunflowers in the field in April, but if we had a rye, winter rye cover crop in there, we would not be able to have that bed ready in any way. So if we wanted to plant something in April or March, a better option would be a cover crop that would winter kill, like tillage radish or buckwheat or sorghum Sudan grass, because those will never survive the winter here. Radishes might, so be careful, but they might, yeah, they'll never survive the winter here. So just as an illustration, when we are looking at cover crops, you know, we read about oats and we're like, everything says oats will winter kill in zone 7. Well, maybe.
But they
didn't. Now, maybe if we got a real Arctic blast, or maybe we needed to plant them earlier so they'd be bigger going into the winter to die.
Right.
But that didn't happen for us. And so that was a little bit of a pickle because we needed those beds. And there is usually something you can do. So the oats hadn't sent up stalks yet. They were just in their leafy phase, and they were nice and tender and soft. So what we did was we weed-eated them as low as we could. The reason we used a weed eater is because you can get so close to the ground with that. And then we put a tarp over them and for about maybe 4 weeks, and that killed them. But I don't know, with like something big and stubbly and tough, we may, like rye, you know, that we may have had a hard time doing that. So the same thing is true, for example, if you want to plant sorghum Sudan grass without a tiller, you will not kill it until it frosts and it dies in the winter. So while sorghum Sudan grass is a great crop, cover crop for producing biomass, don't plant it for a bed that you're going to need to plant like in September, because it's probably not going to be dead yet. And so just not selecting the right cover crop for the time of year and the method by which you're going to terminate it, I would say, is probably the number one pitfall for cover cropping in a no-till system.
And, you know, yeah, that's so true. I'm just thinking of the cover crop nightmares that I've created for myself over the years. There's a lot to consider before you just plant a cover crop. So we won't go down that rabbit hole yet. So, all right, so you have planned how you're going to terminate it. Tell us about the amount of time it takes to terminate. What are those steps? And, you know, we know that what the result is that the beds aren't going to be ready on time. So how do you terminate?
Right. So that goes right up there with selecting the right cover crop. So if you select a cover crop and you say, well, the way I'm going to terminate it is by mowing it or stomping it, crimping it, and then putting a tarp on it, occultation, which is a very popular method for terminating cover crops among no-till farms. And that's what we do when we're doing these like rye type cover crops. It's going to depend on the cover crop and the time of year, but you just need to keep in mind that what you're trading here is not tilling, you're trading that for time. So the tiller is like the big eraser. You mow down your crop, you come through, and it might, you can just erase what you did. You till it into the ground. If it was a mistake, you can till it and it's gone. If it's just the perfect timing, you can till it and the bed will be ready to go soon after that. But when you're using occultation, you really need to allow quite a lot of time. Now, for something like winter rye, which is very woody, and then it's not very warm when you're terminating that, you know, you could be needing 6 to 8 weeks of time under a tarp for that to break down. Or something like buckwheat, which is breaks down very quickly, and it's hot, usually hot when you have buckwheat, maybe 2 or 3 weeks might be adequate. Maybe even less if you mow it down at a time when it won't do any regrowth. So just keep that in mind. And when you do pull the tarp back, if you have a like something grassy like sorghum Sudan grass or rye, the top probably won't be broken down. You'll actually have a nice straw mulch on top of the bed. But the roots will have broken down enough for you to get in there and transplant something. That actually, to jump back to cover crop selection, keep that in mind. If you're going to be trying to direct seed a bed, a grass like a grain is probably not a good choice of cover crop for right before you're going to be doing that.
Don't you, I'll ask this in here at this point. I mean, I generally tell people until you get some experience under your belt, for me, our go-to warm cover crop is buckwheat because of the reasons that you just suggested that, that it breaks down really, really quick. And so that just, it allows for a lot of kind of hiccups more than any other for the warm season. So buckwheat has always been the one I say, when you're getting started with cover crops, stick with buckwheat for warm season until you figure out how you're doing all these steps. And for winter over, I feel like crimson clover also falls into that, the easiest to extinguish. Would you agree with that? When you do it at the proper time, the most manageable to learn with. They're kind of like the grade one.
Yeah, absolutely. What those two cover crops have in common is they don't add a lot of biomass. So right. if you're looking at cover crops, which for everyone who wants more information about cover crops, this book that I'm holding up right now, Managing Cover Crops Profitably, which is put out by SARE, is a great resource. And if you look in there and it says a cover crop adds a lot of biomass, it's going to take longer to break down, more
right.
carbon.
That's a great point.
Yeah, so I definitely agree about buckwheat and crimson clover. Now, our cover crop flowers that we grow in our tunnels, we plant those at a very low density because that's what we can manage at this time in our life. And we just go in there and lop them off and leave the roots in the ground. Those roots then, you know, continue to provide nutrients to the soil life for a while after we do that. And we do that with our vegetables too, like tomatoes, broccoli. We just lop them off and leave the roots in the ground. And because we're transplanting, we can just plant around those plants. If you were direct seeding, you'd have to figure out what would work for you. There are some other options, things that we don't do, but I've heard Jenny Love mention, if you listen to any of her podcasts in the past, I think she may crimp or mow some cover crops, tarp them for maybe just 3 days, just enough to sap some of their vigor.
Right.
Put down some cardboard and then put a compost mulch on top of that. And that allows for a very quick turnaround. So there are other options. There are even cover crops that will just die when you mow them and not try to grow back at all. And then you might be able to immediately plant into that. We don't have any experience with that. So just keep in mind that if you're using a tarp to terminate the cover crop, you need to allow weeks for that process to take place, unless you're adding some extra barrier like a cardboard mulch.
And, you know, I want to say two things. First, if you're listening to us on a podcast app, I want you to know that you can actually listen to this and watch us over on my YouTube channel. And you can see Jonathan and I and see the book that he just held up. So I didn't mention that at the beginning.
And you can see that amazing wall of dried flowers behind you.
Yeah. Yeah. These are all the, this is would have been the compost from this last month, this last season. I mean, unbelievable, really. I had the greatest year experimenting with, we just hung everything up that we didn't have a place for. And it was really a very interesting experiment. And I'm like, so all about it now. Anyway, you know, the thing I think people need to realize about cover crops is there is no one size fits all. They all have different purposes, perhaps, and there are so many different ways to handle them. And you really need to know a little bit about it. And I think that's why I always suggest those two low biomass, because managing the biomass, I created the biggest mess here on my farm last year, growing sun hemp, which is an amazing biomass additive. If you can figure out how to get it into the soil without killing your equipment, it's a lot. I mean, that stuff grows 12 to 15 feet tall here, and it gets a gorgeous flower on it, of which holds up, by the way, about 10 to 14 days in a vase. Looks like a yellow orchid is what it looks like. Anyway, Stevie made me promise I will never grow it again. 2 years in a row, I've just not figured it out. I mean, I know there's a code, but I just haven't figured that code out. So you really need to really choose wisely.
And yeah, then, I think it's to never let it get more than 4 feet tall.
There you go. But it's so beautiful. And I sound like the novice farmer that did not, when I just said, it's like, when that stuff is 12 feet tall with that beautiful flower and with our wind here, it is like sitting on a ship watching the waves go by. I mean, it is so amazing. But there was, I won't even go into the details of the nightmare that he and I went through. I have a great man because he stuck with me and we got it figured out. Golly. So Jonathan, tell us also, people sometimes have trouble getting cover crops to germinate. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part about growing a successful cover crop in a no-till system is getting it to germinate, because I bet what you probably do in your areas where you till is you put the seed out and then you run over it with the tiller and mix it in and get it good seed to soil contact. And without that contact, especially for things with larger seeds, they just won't grow. The pitfall here is really all of these, it's just not having a plan in advance. So I can tell you what doesn't work is growing your cover crop on top of the ground. That doesn't work. And
I've tried it too. It doesn't work.
And even for us, we only have mediocre success by going over it with a rake. You know, a lot of people will chop the cover crop in with a rake. Meh. Has been our experience.
Yeah.
So some of the things that we do to have increased success, and this depends on how you feel about, I mean, there's no official definition of no-till. So I know farmers who don't till who have a precision gauge on their tiller that allows them to till at only 1/8 of an inch deep. And they'll go over that. We have what's called a power harrow, which is like an egg beater for the soil that we'll occasionally use to improve our seed to soil contact. But actually, one of the things we mostly do is we chop the cover crop in, and then we do our annual compost application just on top of the seeds and let that sort of push the seeds down into the soil and get them the dark and moist that they need.
How deep, how thick a layer of compost do you put?
Half inch to an inch, you know.
Not much.
If you're doing something like clover or even buckwheat, like if you put 3 inches, it just won't come up through that. The other thing that really helps with that is some sort of overhead sprinkler. Especially if you're just chopping the cover crop in, actually putting out just a lawn impact sprinkler or whatever type of sprinkler you have, not till they germinate, but until they actually have some roots that are getting down to where the water is in the soil.
Sure.
That can really help. And it's really easy as long as you have access to the water. So we would just definitely recommend people consider that.
So you said chop it in. Tell us what that is.
You just take a rake and sort of I don't even know how to describe it. We just rough up the soil. We don't just rake it back and forth. We're doing some vertical motions with the rake.
Okay.
Stir the soil up a little bit.
Okay.
So we've had
that's good an support. Effort to get the seed down deeper, right? To get it covered. Okay.
Another thing that we've had a lot of success with in the winter, but not in the summer, is putting out straw as a mulch.
Yeah.
On top of the cover crop seed and then watering it. Watering it is important, but that helps keep that moisture in there. We haven't had luck with that in the summer when it's hot and things dry out quickly, but with rye, winter rye and crimson clover, that has worked well.
And something that I've heard from people, what I think we don't understand or realize when we're planting cover crops is, when you plant those seeds well or not well, and with the right conditions that they need to germinate, I can promise you what is going to germinate. And those are all the weed seeds that are out there in your garden.
They are.
And you lose the battle. I have an area, we have a bumper crop of henbit this year. And in one part of the front of my garden, which has clover, and it germinates slower there just because it's got a drainage problem. You want to plant seeds of anything, but really cover crops, when they're going to germinate and provide what they need so they'll germinate quick. Because if they lose the battle with the weed seeds, it doesn't matter what they do then, because your weeds are present and are going to make weed seeds. And I don't think I ever understood that for a long time. It's like, you need to plant the seed at the optimum time for it to germinate as quick as possible. If that means if you don't have water, you better wait until some rain's coming or something. Yeah. You have to take those steps, because once the weeds start growing, you're done. Those cover crops are never going to thrive and overtake them.
Yeah, that's one reason we really like buckwheat, because even if the weeds do germinate, by the time it's time to terminate the buckwheat, they haven't gone to seed yet. And then
exactly. It's quick. Yep.
Yeah.
So, it's really, really quick.
That's one thing we really like about buckwheat. Two other ways of getting some good seed to soil contact, that these are not things that we do, but we know farmers who do this, so it can be done, is use a concrete roller, which is just like a big heavy mesh tube with a handle, to just roll back and forth on the bed and sort of push things down, or to use a push seeder. We've tried that with an earthway seeder and it didn't work great for us, but I think people who have a seeder with a disc, like a Jang seeder, I think it worked well for them, because it can cut through some of that other stuff that might be in your bed. So those are things that we don't do, but other people do, to get cover crops established in a no-till system. And I think what that comes back to, what you said earlier, is just that there isn't a way to do it. There are lots of ways to do it. So that's sharing the ways that we have experience with. It's also sharing the ways that I've heard other farmers do things. I guarantee there's 100 more ways that I haven't heard about or tried. And so I would encourage people to, and I mean, now we're blessed in this age of social media. So other farmers are probably putting on Instagram how how they're starting their cover crops, or you're right. able to find it. I mean, there'll be ways to learn, and you have to experiment yourself too. So,
I mean, it's so very, very true. I mean, I am this morning when I was doing a little bit of writing, it came to me, it's like, you can look at social media as entertainment or education. There is a lot of good educational information out there if you can clear the smoke out of the way to get down to the nitty gritty of the good stuff that's out there. So I agree with you. I think that we all find a way to make work what we have available to us, you know? I mean, so that's why there's so many different ways. It's like, oh, well, gosh, I don't have that, but I wonder if this would work. So Jonathan, so you do incorporate cover cropping, obviously, into your no-till. What would you say to somebody that's just getting started? Maybe they're a small flower farmer and they're doing no-till. If you aren't able to figure out and to be able to do cover cropping, what is your recommendation that they practice until they can cover crop? I mean, for us, we just always put a layer of compost. We did soil tests. We used organic fertilizers when needed so that we're feeding our soil. What other steps can they help to maybe make up for not being able to cover crop perhaps at this point?
Well, like I said, our solution was to transplant flowers into the bed. And when I say low density, we plant one row down the middle, 2 feet apart. So our 80-foot bed gets 40 plants. Is that putting lots and lots of roots into the soil? No, but it is keeping living roots in the soil. And that's meeting our goal with the resources, time. Right. Mostly with two little kids, it's time and equipment that we have. So I would encourage people to think, well, what could I manage in terms of a low density planting that I already know how to grow that benefits the soil life and the insect life on my farm? I think that would be a great thing. I would also say, if you're able to you're not cover cropping because you're putting in more cash crops, great for you. I don't want anything we've said to discourage people from cover cropping, though. I would say it adds a lot to your soil when you can do it. But if you feel a little bit daunted by it, have a backup plan. You know, I know that I need to transplant X May 1st. So 8 weeks before that, March 1st, I'm going to put down a tarp no matter what. I'm going to mow it and put down a tarp, even if it doesn't seem ready, because 8 weeks is probably going to be enough time to kill or at least really weaken whatever's there. I want to plant sorghum Sudan grass, but if this bed isn't ready because that's such a monster of a plant, my backup plan is I can use this other bed instead. And I think if you have a backup plan, then you won't feel the level of stress if things don't quite work out the way you want. And, you know, then that's how I would recommend someone approach it who wants to do it for the first time.
So that's a great, you know, before we came on, Jonathan and I were talking about, I was telling him that I just feel like with each passing year of Flower Farm, this is our 25th year. Can you believe it? I cannot believe it.
That would be nine for us.
You know, I mean, it just, with each passing year, and you get more experience and wisdom, it just seems to get easier. And I think Jonathan hit the nail on the head. I have backup plans for the backup plans of most everything. And he's right. That is the security that I feel. I mean, it's kind of like having an emergency fund, right? Cash fund for your family. It's like, you know, if you know you have that money sitting over there, some things just don't even cross your radar anymore because it's not a problem for you. Same thing in farming and the same thing, obviously, in cover cropping. So, Jonathan, tell us, I mean, so I mentioned your course. There's something that you do once a year to help people to get even a deeper understanding of what your course is about or to get their questions answered. Tell us about what you do annually that we're coming up on here soon, that you do, you and Megan do for your course.
Yeah, we have a live question and answer session. And so anyone who has bought the course can submit questions, and we answer the questions. We do it on Zoom so people can type in comments or follow up questions. And we do that once a year. So if you just got the course and you watched the whole course and you have a question, you need some clarification, you know, we're there for you for that. There's also a live, not a live, but a Facebook group for people who've taken the course that we can answer some questions on. But if you've taken the course 3 years ago, you've been doing something for a couple of years, you're trying to figure out, well, now I need to change it. What are some ideas for how I might improve on this or do something completely different? Then you can ask that question. So it's really anyone who's taken the course at any point could find that helpful. And even if you're not going to be able to make it to the live Q&A, which I believe is February 20th this year at 8 p.m., you could still submit a question because it's recorded and then it's put into your course library. So you'll still be able to get that answer, hopefully.
You know, that's a great point, Jonathan. I mean, I know that I say that for my course to people, it's like, you know, once you get your business up and running 2 years or even 6 months later, you have new questions. You can come back and get your questions answered. I mean, that's so very true for your course too. I mean, for everybody's course, sometimes you just get all caught up in your own little world, right? So friends, if you want to learn more about Jonathan and Megan's course, which is the no-till micro-scale flower farm course, it's on demand. What that means is you can purchase it at any time. It's about 4 hours, isn't it, Jonathan?
That sounds right.
Yeah. And so it's broken up into sessions and it's awesome, y'all. I mean, I'll just give you one little nugget. So Jonathan, by his other job, is a fireman. And one of the things that he teaches you in there, or one, I can't remember if the session is named this, how to fold up a silage tarp without getting a divorce. It's about how you do a lot of the jobs and store stuff. And I mean, this course has so much great information, and not to even mention about just family life. So Jonathan, I think, do you want to mention anything else about your course before we drop off here?
Yeah, I mean, we just wanted it to be practical for people. So it's really focused on how to do things, how to make decisions. And it's not just no-till, although that's a big part of it. I think if you have a tiny farm, like in your urban yard, there's a whole section just on micro farms. So that section might benefit you, you know, even if you're not interested in no-till, or even if you till, some of the no-till information could be helpful, like how to handle some of these materials. Infuriating materials, I think, is what we call it.
That's it. That's what it was. I mean, that's pretty priceless. So I think there is an incredible amount of practical information. I mean, there's just nothing like learning from people that have done it and are doing it, which is what kind of we really try to focus all of our courses on. And I just appreciate you joining us here today. And you can learn more. They'll be, of course, below this video or on below the podcast in the show notes. We'll put the links to all the things that have been mentioned here. The book that Jonathan mentioned, that USDA table that he mentioned as well, to his course, and learn more about it. So Jonathan, thanks so much for taking time to be here today.
Thank you, Lisa. I really enjoyed it.
All right, friends, until we meet again, ciao.